One of them wanted to be the security guy. He claimed he was a security guy.
Thrown off because no applause. Well, that's okay. All right, welcome. Welcome, boys and girls, to another exciting episode of Sterling Everything. Mr. Tony, I suppose you're wondering why I'm wearing this. Is this the brightest orange shirt you've ever seen?
Have you been on the side of the road picking up trash?
Well, I broke out. No. Well, I broke my foot the other day. Now, I got the broken leg. You've seen all the pictures,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I got my little tricycle, and I'm wheeling about, and I don't know, I hit a stick or something, like when you were kids and we had metal wheels on our skateboards and you go flying, and I don't know what happened, and I wind up upside down, and it hurts, and I go to the doctor. Oh, yeah, it looks like you broke your foot. I said, my foot wasn't broken originally. Well, it's broken now. I said, okay, that's great. And then everybody starts making fun of him on Facebook and says, one guy, one of my consultant buddies, O'Donnell, says, we're going to have to hire you a security safety director. Follows you around.
Right.
So my doctor says I should wear this orange shirt just to
make sure people stay away.
Stay away. That's right. Be very close.
Or I saw the one where they wrap you in bubble wrap.
Bubble wrap. Yeah, all the jokes. Very funny. Well, you know what? These people are listening. And then the other big complaint I got last week was of my reappearance was my hair. Now, they don't say, boy, Chuck, that was a really introspective, interesting intellectual discussion about cybersecurity. They want to know why my hair was flat. So I said, I don't know, because it's long or something. But
that's hilarious.
These are the troubles of live broadcasting.
That's true.
What can I say?
That's true.
So today I thought we'd make it much more interesting than all that boring stuff and talk about 420 security.
Ooh.
And you know what that means, right? I'm an older guy, so I don't really know what it means.
Afternoon or morning?
Do you know where that term comes from?
Tell me. Because I can't
remember. And our guest is going to confirm this for me because he's the expert. But I read a story that back in the day, somewhere, of course, in San Francisco land, some kids got in trouble, got to detention, and it was at 420. And that was the period they had to do, and they went and smoked pot all day. That's what. And so that's the term. So I'm not sure if that's absolutely true.
It could have been 315 or anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's where it came from. So welcome, Mr. Ted Gutierrez. Mr. Ted, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you, gentlemen?
How is Cyber Threpagon doing? You were working
on
a big attack last week, right?
What's that?
You had a big attack last week Charisse was working on.
Yeah, we did. We did. We were able to figure out where that attack came from, locked it down on the firewall, so just another day in cybersecurity. But looking forward to hearing about the security of 420. Excited about it. I'm not sure, like you, what that means. I'm looking to learn more.
Well, it's very interesting. We're going to speak right now with Zachary Venegas of Helix TCS Inc. and Helix, HELIXTCS.com. Welcome, Zachary. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me.
So, give us a brief oversight on what Helix TCS does.
So, we provide essentially operating environments for cannabis dispensaries and for cannabis growers. So, as you know, cannabis is a very highly valuable commodity or crop, and so growers and dispensary owners need security to move cannabis and cash across the economy. So we provide that, meaning transportation of cash and cannabis. We provide standing guards for stores, meaning dispensaries and grow operations day and night. We provide monitoring and oversight. We provide other transport capabilities for people who want to move edibles, oils, extracts, or anything else that has to do with cannabis that's high value. We also provide regular services and security like investigation. And we have a very substantial, one thing that is a bit different than the rest of our field is that we provide a very substantial data and competitive intelligence function that's customized for everyone's individual needs. My original experience in security, I was a former Army officer, and I used to run a small private military company called Omega Strategic Services, where we focused mainly on the Middle East and Africa. And so during that period, we gained a lot of experience with competitive intelligence. That's something that we bring to the space on a customized basis. So that's us in general. And obviously, we're publicly traded, and we've been around just about 15 months now. We only started in September of last year.
Publicly traded? That's a new one. So you went right out of the chute being publicly traded, the venture capital got raised?
Pretty close to that. We started in September, so we were licensed in the state of Colorado. I believe it was September 21st. We had our first client, I think, October 21st. We were public December 27th or 28th, somewhere around there. So we did go public relatively quickly in order to allow us to make the appropriate acquisitions and for us to grow. My partners and I originally were private equity investors as well and entrepreneurs. And so we had a very specific growth and operation plan that we wanted to adhere to. And so because the industry is growing so quickly, in order for you to make acquisitions, you're going to need, you know, you can't just do it purely by cash. You have to have some way of aligning the interest of acquired companies or partners, and that's how we chose to do it. And so far, it's worked out pretty well. We're we're over $2.5 million in run rate revenue from a standstill, which makes us one of the, if not the biggest, close to the biggest pure play. There are a few other firms out there that are as big or bigger, but they generate substantial amounts of revenue outside of the cannabis industry. We do only cannabis.
Well, that's pretty impressive. The marijuana industry is so fraught with different levels of players, right? There's the guy that grows it in his backyard. There's the farms back east. We had a guy. Who was the guy we had on the show last year, Tony? He worked in a manufacturing plant, right? You guys do any manufacturing plants?
We guard extractors, if that's what you mean. We do guarding of extraction facilities.
Well, a facility, if that's what they, yeah. They're not making marijuana. They're growing and doing something else.
Right, right. And then they use it for extraction, correct.
So I'm not going to pass any comment on this subject. It's not a moral comment to me. This is the law. And so if you want to smoke marijuana, it's legal. That's fine. Here's my question to you. How do you reconcile the conflicts between the federal law and state law? Because, I think technically it's still federally against the law. Am I right about that? Yeah.
That is correct. It is still on a state-by-state basis, 23 states, it's legal in one form or another, whether it's medical or recreational or both. At a federal level, it is a Schedule I substance, which means illegal. So for me, I think it's based on where the state where you live and operate. So I am personally a teetotaler. I've never had a beer, much less smoked a joint. So I'm not a lifestyle participant. For me, as an entrepreneur and a private equity investor or a venture capitalist investor, I saw an opportunity as a frontier market. So I spent most of my career after the Army, and I also used to work for J.P. Morgan covering the Middle East. But after that, I started my own private equity firm. I spent all of my time in what we would call frontier markets. So Iraq, Afghanistan, Congo, Ghana, Romania, Morocco, places like that. And so we have good experience looking at frontier markets, what they look like and what they do as they develop. And so frontier markets are often characterized by dual legal systems or legal exceptions to the law of the land that people operate under. So that's not entirely new by any stretch. It's certainly not in frontier markets. And so I think it's, all law enforcement is local, and because cannabis is not allowed to cross state lines, as long as you're adhering to the local laws, meaning the state law that you're operating in, I think the Cole memorandum lays out scope for this industry, obviously, to develop as it has. And so since we had experience with frontier markets, we just saw it as another frontier market in which we could participate. We had strong domain experience with security and security operations, competitive intelligence. And so it was just like being anywhere else, without risking, coup d'etats and amoebic dysentery and terrorism and all these other things that we normally dealt with on a day-to-day basis. So that's what attracted us to it. And knowing that it's legal on a state level and to not be too coy, but it is a states' rights issue. So we felt pretty comfortable that as long as we're adhering to the promulgated guidelines, that we'd be in good shape and able to operate.
Talk with Zach Venegas of Helix TCH. I'm doing a little side broadcast here for you, Zach, to tell people that coming up at 7 o'clock on Facebook Live, we'll have the entire interview about 420 Security. And Zach's company, Helix TCH, is the biggest provider of a whole, you call it an operational solution. You're talking handling money, distribution, the security, background checks, intelligence, the full solution for the growing marijuana industry. And we're going to be talking about that live at 7 o'clock, so make sure you guys tune in. And I'll see you on Facebook in a few minutes. All right, so we're back to our broadcast. So we had a guy on here last year. He wrote a fictional book, which I think was wink, wink, some of his antics he was talking about. Now, here's what I know about marijuana clinics in L.A., and you probably know more than I do about it, but I was at a guard company several years ago, the one that will go nameless. Remember that one? We don't talk about the name. And some guy calls him and says, hey, you got a good reputation. We want you to do all our clinics. And the guy had quite a few clinics, and it was going to be quite a lot of money for the company. I wasn't comfortable, Zach. I didn't know that much about it, although, right. You know, I know the very detailed things about access control backgrounds and things that you know, but I don't know them in the context, which is so important, right? And at the time, correct. We had, you know, we're supposed to have 400 marijuana clinics, and we had, what, 1,200? You know, so there's all those extra clinics and nobody knew anything about. I wasn't comfortable. Another thing the guy talked about was handling a lot of cash. So why is there so much cash in the marijuana business? I'm thinking because, A, we had the federal issue, and B, if you put more than $10,000 in the bank, you're not supposed to report it, or you have to report it to the IRS, right? And so maybe they just hoard cash. Well, it seems to me that it operates not dissimilar from when it was not legal. Am I wrong?
Right. I think the primary reason that cash is such a critical component of the cannabis economy is because cannabis is still illegal on a federal level, it's not easy to access banking.
Oh, yes.
And so the cash piles up in everyone's store, and there's several ways to handle it. You can have it transported to a vault, or you can store it on site, or for instance in the state of Colorado, banking by state licensed bank or credit unions is becoming much more common. And I remember when we started about a year ago, probably 3/4 of our clients paid in cash. Today, I would say probably only 1/4 of our clients pay in cash, the rest pay by check. So they're accessing banking facilities. So it depends on the state. Again, Colorado has been operating, I think it's one of the more advanced states in terms of its cannabis economy. So within the state of Colorado, if you have a legitimate business, you can access banking services now. Because, again, it's not federally legal, there's some debate around this, but there's also limited access to credit cards and limited access to credit card transactions. There are some workarounds, but again, depending on the more workarounds you use, the more operating risk you incur. So, you know, when you have one gray area, meaning federally illegal, legal on a state level, that's a gray area. Then if you add to that whether or not credit cards are actually, which are backed by national banks, are usable, that's another gray area. So many firms choose not to stack too many gray areas.
That makes sense.
One on top of the other as they operate. So cash is still king in cannabis, but not because it's akin to the old days, the bad old days where it was illegal and, you know, illegal drug dealing is cash based.
Right.
But just because there's not full access to the banking system. And I suspect that that will be another driver. That certainly is another driver towards full legality on a federal level so that you can have everybody with full access. And while that would take away one source of revenue in the cannabis business for security, that's by no means our largest stream of revenue. And we look forward to the day when everyone can have a bank account and make it safer.
Let's talk about your verticals. So I heard, first of all, what was the term you used about operational? The word operation was in there.
Oh, operating environment. So
yeah,
we focus on just.
And that's a lot of different places.
Correct. And right. it depends on even within a given state, it can mean different things in different places. So, for instance, Colorado has very clear, well laid out laws about what everyone has to do and can do. And so it's relatively easy to set up a suite of services that allow people to sort of outsource as much or as little of the operating risk besides growing or selling cannabis to us as they'd like. In other states you have, like California, yes, it's legal, but the regulations and the laws are not fully promulgated, and law enforcement hasn't fully weighed in yet on how they want those enforced. So therefore, there's a lot more gray area, and so you're going to find a much wider spread of operating norms within, you know, the state and perhaps within places in the same county or within the same city.
Now, Ted, you used the word promulgated. You're going to have to get the dictionary out there for me. back me up with these big words. And, you know, Security Guy Radio's got a limited vocabulary with my injured leg here. I don't think as clearly. I'm just teasing. Let's talk about your vertical market, Zach.
Sure.
When I did mine, I was offered, you know, guarding the store. And if the burglar alarm get off, we'll do a little response. We weren't charged with or asked to do the cash. And, they, you know, they had guard or somebody to do that. You're getting into that, I suppose. So let's, you know, so let's talk about the money. Let's talk about compliance, because I assume you have to know what the laws are for each clinic in each state.
Correct.
And then we have, I see, guarding, compliance, intelligence, and I'm not going to call it banking, but, you know, cash handling, I guess. Those are four verticals
so
you do,
cash
right?
Handling.
Yeah.
Right.
Talk about each one of those.
So cash handling, we'll go in reverse order. Cash handling is just what it sounds like. We transport cash from point A to point B. There's some firms in our space in the state of Colorado that take it all the way to the government revenue collection window. Some do, some don't.
Or
it
no.
all depends on whether or not you want to invest in armored vehicles or not.
So let's talk about that, because I want to catch a point here. So they can't really go down to the Culver City Credit Union and stick it in the bank like I do, because it's so much
Correct.
Money. They can't put it under their mattress. They're not shipping it on a boat overseas. What are they doing with it? They're taking it to the Federal Reserve, or where's it going?
So many firms have bank accounts, state licensed bank accounts,
right.
Credit unions, and they take it. They have the cash transported there, just like anyone else would.
Okay, because they're going to pay taxes, and that's all okay. That's all legit.
Correct.
Okay,
absolutely correct. And so that's how that works. That's how the cash handling part works. There's also some people choose to have it vaulted. Some people like their cash taken out of their stores, collected, and placed in a vault. And then taken to the revenue window or their bank account or wherever they want the destination to go. There are some larger firms like Guard of it who do revenue window runs. They'll take cash to the revenue window for the state or the federal government. And so they're in that business, but they don't go, let's say, store to store. And then within that, there's whether or not you run armored car services. So we don't. That's a philosophy, and that's a philosophical and operational detail. So for us, when you run armor, we have experience in a lot of other places in the world, you know, where you're running high value transit with armored vehicles, where you can get into, you know, situations. So when you run armored for cannabis, you do that for the security of your cargo, which is great. But there's an idea, I think, out there, and I think I do subscribe to it, that we don't want to have a shootout in the street over a load of cannabis in the back of an armored vehicle. So we have to be very, very careful as an industry about how we are transporting the cannabis among the public. And while we don't want to be easy marks, at the same time, we don't want to invite high-level violence, you know, around the industry in any way. So
that makes sense.
So, you know, that's why you don't see lots of, you know, the big armored Brinks trucks running around delivering, you know, dropping off cannabis.
Yeah, I asked about cash, but cannabis is cash for all practical purposes. It's
yes, and they're treated essentially the same way. I mean, there are rules, obviously, around handling, but cannabis and it's any like any other high-value transit item.
I don't want to create any Hollywood movie plots here, but where does this stuff come from usually? Does it come from a private grower? Does it come from a corporate kind of grower, or, you know, where does that start, and then it gets transported to
right.
the individual shops and stuff? I think it's very fascinating to me. I mean,
I mean, it's all of the above. So there are some growers that you would certainly corporate. They're large, multi-store, multi-grow, produce large amounts of cannabis and have professional growers in every way. Those are corporate. You would say if you saw them, they're like any other corporate grower or a big ag company. And then there's quite a bit, I would say maybe just under half the market. I think they now produce more than half of the market.
Wow.
And by volume. And then you still have what other people would consider to be mom and pops, which are one or two grow operations where they may produce a high amount of cannabis, but it's only one or two locations. And they don't have the, you know, sort of the, all the bells and whistles of a large corporation, big bank lines and, long-term growing programs, things like that. So there's a mix, and we pick it up from all. We service the smaller to the larger. And although I think that as cannabis, once it's no longer state by state, there's all different aspects of it that we have to prepare for. So, for instance, one thing that I think people don't talk about very much, but when it does come off Schedule One, assuming that it one day does, and you can transport cannabis across state lines, I believe that the Native Americans will have a very big advantage in terms of power and water, which are the two biggest cost components, cost inputs of cannabis, in producing it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how people compete with that when, you know, native lands are able to do things with power and water that other people can't.
Yeah.
And so that'll change the transport and grow profile of the industry greatly, I think, when that day does come.
Now, define big for us in this industry. You had mom and pop, but even a mom and pop, can't they make $1 million a year doing something like that?
Sure.
That's small, absolutely. Right? Small, million small. That's not big.
Yeah, so you can do $1 million is I would say, certainly within the realm of a smaller entrepreneur. I think large are firms that are making top-line revenue maybe $500,000 a month or more.
Wow. Tony, sell the station. Wow. We got to do something else. Ted, cybersecurity's out, dude. We got to do this.
Yeah, this is
that's amazing.
This is very interesting talk.
And how many states is it in now, Zach, after the last election? Is it 24 states have some kind of law?
23 states, some sort of law. You have some states like Colorado, which has rec and med, right? So that's the high end. And then you have other ones that have limited. Then you have states like California, which have passed laws for medicinal and recreational. But again, they're not fully operational yet. And I expect that that'll happen sometime this year. And again, state by state, it's very, very different. You have some high population states like Illinois that have not seen the type of growth in previous years that one might expect when you have cities like Chicago. You have some states that like Maryland or Massachusetts, which are, I think, highly anticipated, even though neither one of them is considered a massive, or Massachusetts, Boston, but they're certainly not New York City or L.A. But the way the laws are expected to be rolled out, people, I think, are highly anticipating those states coming up to full speed and being sort of high revenue states.
Let's talk
you run the gamut.
Let's talk about guarding services. So I was reluctant to put my guards in there. He wanted armed, this guy. And I said, you know, cops have enough trouble with training. I don't have training for guards for that. So I balked on that. How do you handle the placement of guards? We have background checks, obviously. But, you know, I was always worried about, you know, contact. They're on a contact high, stands around the clinic all day maybe.
Or sure.
Practical considerations, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the science around that keeps you pretty safe.
Okay.
Contact high stuff. So for my firm, again, this is wide divergence in the industry for security in this. Some firms openly talk about that their guards use cannabis to monitor, to handle their PTSD if they're former military or police.
Oh.
That's not us. So, you know, we believe that cannabis in your bloodstream and a weapon in a closed, small enclosed area and civilians walking around is not a great
not a great
combination.
Fit. Yeah.
So we are drug-free, random drug testing, zero tolerance in terms of our guards and how we handle that. But the guarding is we have a fairly substantial – we have the most substantial in the industry, the longest training program. We have a pretty – our head of operations, a gentleman by the name of Grant Whitus, was the SWAT team leader at Columbine, at, you know, that terrible shooting. Platte Canyon, he's a pretty experienced SWAT operator and trainer. And we make sure that all of our men, 90% of whom are former military and police, are highly trained. We do place them typically armed. We do unarmed as well, but we typically place them armed. That's usually what people are asking for. But it's just like you would imagine any guarding any other post is like. They monitor IDs, they manage people flow, they ensure the proper number of people are allowed into the viewing area, the purchase area, and it's not becoming overcrowded. I won't say crowd control, but certainly flow control.
Right.
You know, by definition of who they are and their appearance to the public, they set the tone in the dispensaries and the grows and are in some cases almost part of the furniture to help the dispensary owner make his sales, because it's they're normally the first person that everyone sees.
Does the guarding environment feel like the Diamond Exchange downtown? Do you have a double door sally ports, buzzers on the doors? You know, it's very slow and controlled, small people working in the
yes.
space. Yeah.
I would say more that than anything else. But there is variation. Some dispensaries, like, they really go far to try and keep that sort of freewheeling, you know, like you would think a cannabis store would be like, especially ones that go for the high end. Some of them go for a high end user experience or buyer experience. And so they want it to be, they don't want security to be as prominent, but most of them, you know, it's, you get buzzed in, there is flow control. There is, you get your ID check, you have to sit and wait in case the back area is full. And so it is a bit more like that than, let's say, going to Target.
I do feel good about drawing from a different pool. Ted, you can speak to this about your military background.
Absolutely.
Would you feel comfortable going and getting a job as a security guy in a marijuana clinic, given your background? You got the right stuff for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I understand kind of the type of feeling there is to walk into an organization like that and not know what to expect. And the tone is set by the first person you see. That makes a lot of sense. My question is, how was your company able to dominate that market so quickly? Is there some offering that you have that traditional security firms in your vertical just don't offer or didn't have the experience? How did you guys capitalize on that market? Is there something else besides, you know, any other regular security type job out there that you guys just do better than anybody else?
You seem to be turkey to me. That's what I picked up on.
One-stop shopping. So. Very well planned out. It's very interesting, the business concept. But from a unique supplier perspective, what would you say really sets you guys apart?
I would say our people, I think, are a big part of it. I of course, everyone's biased, but I do think I have, you know, the best operators in the business. I'm sure everyone, you know, feels the same way about their men, but I feel that. The other thing is, as a firm, you know, I have a lot of private equity experience for many years before that, and I had experience in high-end security as a CEO. And since I started the company originally with, you know, our own capital and our own necks on the line, I was living in South Africa for and overseas for years before coming back to New York City. And then actually moved my family for our 14th move to make sure that this got started the right way. So I would say we had good people, we were well capitalized, and we have good experience in a high value type security operations. Not all of the firms that are out there are run by people with high end security experience and a private equity background. I think that makes a difference in terms of what we thought we would have to offer to clients, how we ran the business. We have a slightly different business model. I think that makes a significant difference in terms of attracting people. The fact that we did go public relatively early and all of our guards are offered a chance to own stock. And we went public. I think we were around 12 cents a share. And even though it is a very tight float, physically speaking, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I think we closed at $8.10 a share today. So, you know, that's significant balance sheet building for our guards, and everyone has an option. And I think that motivates people to try and be part of the firm. And we've done we've just hit a lot of goals. We set very specific revenue growth, retention goals, and we keep hitting them. And as we do that, I think people feel comfortable and then they give it their best. And I think that's a big part too.
Yeah, that's excellent. A very unique model. Very good. Now, let's talk about the logistics intelligence part. So this is a great component because, you know, traditional guard services or protection services are put a guy there at the desk, put him at the gate, at the door, and check ID and we're all done. And I've always said that's the worst model, you know, because if you know somebody's coming or you know there's a problem, you handle it before the guy gets to your facility and you're better off. So we don't want you to give away any trade secrets, but tell us in general how you work that intelligence part to help the clients make good business choices.
Right. So there's two distinct sides to that. One is the competitive intelligence focused on security. The other one's competitive intelligence focused on commercial operations. So competitive intelligence focused on security is just as you mentioned. So it's pattern analysis. It's gathering large amounts of data about traffic, about people that, again, I'll be careful about what I say in terms of, but who's coming to your store, when, at what frequencies. There's a lot of different things that, you know, a retail security operator, you know, he'll understand and know what to look for, and we can be proactive about providing the clients who are after that sort of information with that sort of information. That's on the one side. On the other side, One thing that not everyone knows is that we are also owners of a firm called Cannabase, which is part wholly owned by us. Cannabase is the oldest wholesale market for the cannabis industry in Colorado. And so that's where buyers, licensed buyers and dispensary owners and store and growers can buy large amounts of wholesale cannabis on an exchange. And so because of that, we have two very important agreements with the two largest point of sales software operators in the industry, which is MJ Freeway and BioTrack. So we have direct feeds, not self-reported, not getting it from clients when they feel like giving any information. We have the direct feeds from the point of sales software providers on who's buying and selling wholesale cannabis. So on the commercial side, competitive intelligence side, we're able to, for clients that want it, we're able to give them predictive analytics and a lot of different things that allow them for their operations to run more smoothly. And those type of analytics, one of the things we provide them with is sometimes there are operating details or operating inefficiencies that are making them be prone to things like shrinkage or theft, or making them more vulnerable than others to robbery, or I would say burglary as opposed to robbery. And those are big, problems in the industry, meaning nobody wants it to happen. It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens more frequently than people probably suspect because, as you might imagine, cannabis growers are not the greatest self-reporters in the world in terms of self-reporting incidents and problems. Nobody wants a license to be at risk. Nobody wants, so there's high incentives because a license can be lost. There's very high incentives to, one, do things correctly, but two, a bit of shrinkage here and there or some employee theft. People aren't on that. And you know, speaking of cybersecurity, I just have to put this out there. I don't know if you're aware, but the two firms I just mentioned, MJ Freeway was just recently attacked. That's the that's one of the largest point of sale service providers in the industry, and they were attacked. A very significant attack happened last Saturday, and that's disrupted quite a number of the operators in the industry that they can't operate as they were before. I don't know if you heard about that, but that's
Heard about that in particular, but we'll definitely look into it.
Yeah,
do you know what kind of attack it was?
No, it's very, no one knows anything yet, but hacking has officially come to the cannabis industry.
Wow.
It's like Chuck's always said it. We always said it. We did a lot of interviews at Black Hat last year, and we, you know, the pulse of the industries, and I say industries in plural, is that 2017 will likely be the year that no longer can small companies that never thought about cybersecurity keep doing that. It's, right. It's reaching, a maximum there. And so it's going to be very interesting what plays out in the various industries, which traditionally have been financial and healthcare. I would love to learn more about the cannabis industry because it's growing so much on just a national scale. It's going to be very interesting to see how it all plays out.
So I'm glad to hear we have more burglaries and robberies because I seem to recall some big high-profile robberies, which involve, and for my nieces and nephews who watch too much TV and think a robbery is a burglary, it's not. Robbery's taking by force of fear with a gun or something. And burglary, you're breaking in and taking something when nobody's around. So that's much safer. But robberies, you know, in the marijuana business were kind of violent back in the day because there's a lot of cash, cannabis is a cash, so to speak. So if we're doing burglaries, that's better. But do we still have some pretty violent, not home invasion, I guess, shop invasion robberies, or are those things going away now? Because security's better, because they didn't need security back in the day, right?
Excuse me.
Nobody cared about security back in the day.
They do. They happen. They do exist, of course. In any high-value industry, you're going to have those things. There's been only one fatality, to my knowledge. Only one guard has been, and that's one too many, but it happens. So there's been about 8 or 9 months ago, there was a guard that was killed. Not one of ours, thank God. I still feel very sad for his family, and the industry really came together for them. And everyone was supportive of him, and it was pretty. I thought there was a lot of a strong show of support within the industry itself. But we've only had one guard that I'm aware of that's been killed in the line of duty. And I think robberies are just a fact of life. Anytime you have a high value density, object that's out there, people are going to come after it. There's not really much you can do.
Now the reason I ask is because I went back to the police academy and got recertified. two Novembers ago, I think, right? And one of our little updates was about drugs, and the narco guys came in and talked about drugs. And one thing they said was, it's not marijuana, it's not heroin, it's not, you know, bath salts, it's not all those other things that drive the violence. The marijuana growers, illegal, I'm talking about illegal, right, that part of the business, mm-hmm. was the most violent part of the drug business. The most shootings, deaths, takeovers, stealing, all that kind of stuff. So I'm glad this has not transferred to the private industry. And I'm glad that, I think part of it's because of legislation. I mean, California has some pretty comprehensive rules about how you have to set up your marijuana shop security-wise. And, you know, too bad most businesses don't have to do that, although it's cost prohibitive to some, right? You've been radio couldn't afford it. But if you've got a marijuana clinic, I'm thinking you could afford it. So I think that cuts down on some of that stuff. So that's good to hear. I'm glad it's becoming a lot safer. To talk about how you handle cross-state management of these things. Now, is there one guy that was super rich that could open up 25 marijuana clinics in 25 states as long as he complied? You can't do that. I was just wondering, you know, are there legal drug dealers now? You know what I mean? Legal drug kingpins, so to speak. Okay.
I mean, other than Big Pharma, no.
Yeah.
You know, they have that title still, but you can't. And every state is different. Some states have residency requirements. Some states have size requirements, number of license requirements or limitations. So it's different from state to state. But there's a high level of scrutiny. And there are some groups out there who essentially set up in every state independently, but at a top headquarters level are connected.
Right.
So there are some firms, you know, moving to do things like that. But it's because each state is so different. And local connections are very, very important just to run the business and to get certified and to get your license. That hasn't been very easy yet. I think the bureaucratic barriers to entry are difficult and make and sort of deter that type of activity.
That's probably
in terms
good.
Of one big drug dealer.
Probably good for now until we get.
I think
on
so.
All stuff,
yeah. I think so. While people are getting adjusted to the reality of a legalized cannabis in society and all those different things. I think, you know, small steps, I think it's appropriate so people can measure social impact, financial impact, and things like that. I mean, you know, we all know that once big companies get a hold of things, if they want to keep it going in a certain direction, they can, and it's not always the right way. It may not always be to the benefit of society, right? So I think, you know, as a non-consumer of cannabis myself, and I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, I've, you know, from the 80s, and, you know, I've seen what bad drug epidemics look like and how they tear up society. I think we're, you know, I think Colorado has a very good model. I think kind of going slowly and making sure that it's not all just about making tons of money and letting it get out of control. I think it's an appropriate way to go. I don't think we want any, we're trying to minimize social negatives,
right
in the end.
Yeah, so this is the question I always bring up in these things. And Ted, jump in there and tell me what your philosophy is. So I'm not really for any drugs because your body is in a state of what they call, halitosis? I forget what the term is. Well, your body's constantly balancing its own drugs and its own chemicals, right? And when you stick something else in it, it goes, whoa, I got to balance that marijuana. You know, it's hard enough to get through life. And it wouldn't work on me when I was in the hospital with a broken leg. The document says, I'm going to move your leg around. We're going to give you some morphine. We'll be back in a few minutes. And they shot me with morphine. And the guy comes back and says, why don't you go to sleep? And I go, what do you mean? He goes, I gave you enough morphine to put you out for like 12 hours and you're wide awake. And I go, my body does not respond to meds. I'd be a terrible drug addict because it wouldn't work, right? But to each his own, to each his own, as long as you don't come into my house and bother me and steal my stereo and buy marijuana, right? Here's what I don't get. If this stuff's so great, why isn't Big Pharma lining up to make it work and process to put in a bottle, make $1 billion on it? Because they'd make more money than any other drugs they sell now if they did that. Now, I understand that it's federally against the law, so there's no incentive to do research, blah, blah, blah. But boy, they got to see the writing on the law. If 24 states are legalizing it to some degree, Big Pharma's got to go, you know what, let's do some research. So then we can put it in a bottle and sell it. And I wonder if they don't move that way because there isn't the benefit people think. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
I mean, I'm not sure.
I'm a non-user, so what do I do?
Lining up.
Yeah. Really?
You know what I think?
What?
I think that there's a ton of people that want to get involved in this. But the financing, maybe you can help me on this side. But the finances needed to start growing in that industry, in that realm, and to start lobbying and things like that. I mean, it's limited right now because the traditional forms of financing are just not there, even for the entrepreneur. Is that a plot? Is that accurate?
I think it is. I think that is accurate. So one, financing in the cannabis industry in general, not just the security, right, but another institute, is very tight. It's very hard. It's not, I mean, not that obtaining financing is ever easy, but it's tighter than in other industries. And then you also keep this in mind. So one thing I mentioned earlier, I think Big Pharma is lining up to get ready to do this.
Right.
They're lining up ancillary resources and getting ready. But just keep this in mind, because it's still federally illegal. If you're a Big Pharma company and you undoubtedly have federal contracts, you can get yourself into trouble if you're openly pursuing cannabis and, you know,
well, even research. Yeah.
Doing, so you can get yourself into trouble there. So yeah, they have to stay out, or it has to be pursued in a way that it's done by, you know, independent organizations, sort of maybe corporate entrepreneurship, where they have to use alternative means. But there is a lot of activity around Big Pharma. There really is. And there's some smaller firms that are startups where they're mapping genomes and strain types, and those are under heavy scrutiny by the Big Pharma companies. They really are. And so, you know, and as you mentioned, again, benefits, you know, people ask me, look, I'm a West Point graduate, Army officer, infantry guy, third generation soldier myself, my grandfather, father, you know, we're a military family. People say, you know, cannabis. You know, like I say, I'm from, you know, New York. I'm from originally from Brooklyn, New York. You know, what I say in terms of the benefit, in terms of social impact, you know, I've never seen anyone smoke a joint and then, you know, beat his family into the hospital. Right. But I can tell you, I've seen people, you know, growing up in New York, down a six pack and then hospitalize their whole family. Right.
That's true.
So for me, if we can deal with people having a six pack on the stoop and watching the game, you can live with someone, you know, consuming however they consume. So for me, it's pretty easy. If we can deal with alcohol and everywhere you go, everybody trying to make you drink, you know, cannabis is not so bad. I think you're right. Oh, the term you were looking for was homeostasis.
Homeostasis, that's
your
it, yeah.
Body keeping itself straight.
Yeah, that's a great, it's amazing.
Wow,
what your body does
word.
To itself. Yeah, it balances everything. When you try to do something to it, it tries to correct it. And then if you have too many drugs, it says, I give up. My little brother died of all this, so I studied it a lot.
Oh, wow.
And he got out of it towards the end, but his body just was too old by then. At 40, and just gave up, heart stopped, and that was it. And he had, when he died, he was taking 26 pills to not take pills.
Wow.
This pill, he took a pill to make him better, but that made him sick, so he took a pill not to make him sick, and so on and so forth. So I'm just kind of against drugs in general. You know, we probably wouldn't be a perfect world if we didn't have to drink and do drugs and things, but that's not going to happen. So I'm a realist, right, and I'm practical, right? So if you're going to do these things, I just say you got to think it through. You got to be responsible. You can't go with the flow and say, oh, it's all great because somebody said so on Facebook. You got to look at it, you know. So to that point, tell me what the industry is doing to put labeling. I got a friggin' label on my peanut butter jar that I can't even read. So I have to put my glasses on to say, well, how much sugar and how much this and how much that? Drives me nuts. I'm guessing we don't have labels on marijuana packages. It says may contain 5% lawn grass. I don't know. What do they do?
So, again, it's state by state. So in the state of Colorado, you actually do have surprising amounts of labeling in
okay.
terms of edibles. There's lots of warnings and product information that people put in, that manufacturers put in, so you understand what you're getting. And even in terms of traditional bud or consumables, they do. The bud tenders tend to be quite informed, and people know what's organically grown as opposed to inorganically grown. And THC levels are tested. Obviously, consumers of cannabis want to know, you know, what has the most THC or the least THC. And then, in the case of people that are consuming cannabis derivatives like CBD for anti-inflammation properties, who don't want any THC, that has to be indicated on packaging. So I wouldn't say it's at the sort of, you know, like when you pick up a packet of Twinkies. It's not there yet, but it's moving in that direction. And again, I think once it's federally legal, then it'll just fall under in whatever categorization they give it. I think that'll be a way for, again, the FDA to get involved and then have everything labeled, you know, in a standardized way.
Didn't they have some Twinkies on The Living Dead one day? They were on a show for 10 years and they were still good, I think. They've done nothing.
Yeah, I think so.
They've done studies on Twinkies.
Like
they can live forever. So Twinkies may be more dangerous in the long run than some of the other stuff. Give me another vertical market we haven't covered yet.
So we've done, I think we retail transport. So we
transport,
do that,
right?
Which is to say transporting edibles and things from where they're produced to the stores where they're sold, which is, again, we don't do individual delivery of cannabis to people in the state of Colorado.
You're not the Helms Bakery truck here with marijuana.
Right. So it's not like in California we have Ease. Where they do that, right? They deliver, my understanding is that they deliver cannabis to your door.
Yeah. Well, we do a lot of crazy stuff out here. Now,
right. So edibles, that's a different thing. It's not that. We do that. That's relatively straightforward retail transport. And so this, it's not particularly sexy or unusual, but it's as edibles grow, and I believe that they're the fastest growing segment of cannabis,
right?
There's more and more scope for that sort of business.
You know, I'd prefer you eat a cannabis brownie in public than blow smoke in my face. It really annoys me when guys just smoke a butt. And you can drive down the 101 freeway any time of the day or night, Zach, and roll down the windows marijuana on the freeway.
Really?
Oh, it's pretty bad out here. There's no doubt about it. Am I wrong, Tony?
Colorado is not like that. It's illegal to smoke in public in Colorado.
Yeah. So I'm all for the edible thing. That sounds like a good solution. Now, edibles, where do they fall? Do they fall under the same strict food manufacturing guidelines, or they give them a little break because it's marijuana?
So edibles are – it's a different regime. I would say it may be as strict. It's certainly different. The thing about edibles, I will tell you, is dosing, and that's one thing even with packaging. Edibles affect people differently. So obviously I'm not an expert, but I will tell you this in terms of people consuming it in public. Edibles affect people in a way that's has a wider spread of outcomes than it does when people smoke.
Interesting.
So generally, edibles, one person can eat a certain edible, a chocolate, an infused chocolate, and get a certain reaction. Another person eats the same amount. They could be the same weight, you know, but they have a different body chemistry, and it differently affects them. And so because of that wider spread with edibles, I think people, actually the public, should be more careful with edibles as they're going into mainstream consumption than even with the traditional vape or consuming the butt in a cigarette or smoking item you use, because it's a different, you know, it's digested, people's bodies digest differently.
Right?
Yeah, and it's different. I've had some pretty comical experiences with people saying, you know, they come from investors or other people. They say the first thing they want to do is, oh, I want to go to a store, and we take them, and they get, you know, they say, I'm going to eat a whole brownie, and they eat, and then bad things happen. I got to say,
things. They think they're too strong.
Yeah, they say it's just a brownie, and you know, you have to pay attention to labeling. It's important, and you know, these are adults, and so you know, the next thing you know. There, you know, I get a lot of good, funny stories, and I'm dining out on that for a long time.
I did not know that 99. I learned something every day on Screw to Get Rid of, don't you? It's amazing. Zach, give us some war stories. You got some good war stories about some screwy guard story or a difficult transportation or something pretty dicey that you guys solved for people?
I will say I think this is pretty funny. Maybe it's a bit controversial, but you know, there are even stores. There's every kind of store that you can imagine with every kind of theme. And I once was, we had a lot of things going on at once, and there was an issue at a store, and I was going as the CEO, I was going to make sure everything was okay. I don't normally I have a great ops section, but we were very stretched. It was 4:20, right? It was April 20th, so it was crazy that day. And as I walk up, one of my men tells me, oh, hey, you got to not go to the store that you're going to. And I'm saying, I'm almost there. I pull it up in my truck. I'm getting ready to go out. And I'm walking up, and I notice, as I'm getting close, a lot of the people are looking at me in a very particular way, and I'm noticing all sorts of lightning bolts and iron crosses on people. And as I approach the store, I realize that it's a white supremacist cannabis shop.
Oh, interesting.
So I thought that was pretty funny. and obviously they weren't thrilled that I was their service provider. So I thought that was funny.
It is kind of funny.
And, as I looked at it, I said to one of the patrons outside, I said, is this a white supremacist cannabis store? And he looked at me and, you know, he surprisingly said, yes, it is. And he very calmly, and I said, well, thank you. And I just stood and waited for a couple of my guards to show up, and it was no problem, and there was no more drama. But I'm not sure if I thought I still am not sure about that story, but that's a true story. They do exist. You have every kind of theme you might imagine. You have only organic, you have and only this, you have only that, and you also have you know, for those of us who wanna
there's another lawsuit coming, right? You can't sell if I'm gonna get sued if I don't sell you a cake for your gay wedding. And now I'm not going to sell you marijuana because you're black or Hispanic. I mean, we live in an insane world. Maybe we need more marijuana.
It's funny. But I found the fact that it was me, a former soldier, just minding my business, trying to help a client out. Or actually, they weren't really a client. They were, but for the day, they needed some security service. I thought it was kind of funny. I guess it could have turned out quite badly.
Well, they let you do it, right?
Yeah, there was no, you know, in the end,
All money's green. That's the bottom line.
All money's green, and people have problems that they need solved. But it was funny. I think my guys were pretty not sure what was going to happen there. I mean, I if you would have said on the surface of it, I probably wouldn't have been sure what was going to happen there either. Yeah. But I still find that probably one of my favorite ones. That and the fact that when I often go to dispensaries, if I'm in civilian clothes, just checking to make sure that everything's going well. When I leave, people—I don't know what it is about me—but people often think, I'm some sort of drug dealer. As I come up, people always ask me, "Oh, what'd you get?" Big consumer. They say, "What'd you get?" Or, "What's good?" You must smoke heavy stuff, and I'm just like, "No."
Yeah, I'm a Confederate War soldier, so you know,
exactly.
Little white goatee and hair and stuff. I mean, you never know. People are kind of
wacky. You never know.
So, give us one more quick overview. We've got about 5 minutes left. Give us another overview of your scope, how many states, the website, how we can get a hold of you, all that kind of stuff.
Right. So we're operating we operate right now in Colorado. We have operations right now being licensed in California, Oregon, Washington. We're in Nevada. And so that's where we're operating right now. We will be here shortly in Maryland and Massachusetts. What we try to do is make a good assessment on which states are going to have the largest amount of demand and which states have requirements that fit what we can do. Because some states don't have – so, for instance, I suspect that Michigan will have fairly stringent guarding requirements that will be a place where we can immediately gain traction and move. Whereas other states like Illinois, you know, it rolled out slower than everyone thought. And so that hasn't been a state that's been a great focus of ours to date.
All right, excellent. Zach Venegas, CEO, right?
Correct.
Helix TCH. And is it helixtch.com, the website?
Helix TCS.
Oh, TCS. I'm sorry. TCS.com.
Yeah, no problem.
I get my George Lucas film mixed up with that. Zach, thanks for coming on Security Guy Radio. Check out his website.
Thanks
it's very nice, very nice looking interface on your mobile site. It looks great. And tune in next week, boys and girls, for an exciting adventure of Security Guy Radio. Hopefully I'll be perpendicular next week and not fall down one more time. But I got to go to the doctors and get my new brake fixed this week. So,
all right,
we'll see you later on. Thanks for tuning in, Ted. We'll see you next week on Security Guy Radio.
Hey, absolutely. See you later, guys. Great
talk. Gentlemen. All the best.